Bueller. Bueller. Bueller.
That's okay. I'm here. Hey, how
Bueller.
Are you? Sorry.
Bueller.
Hi, how are you? Hey, I'm here. You can let that rest now. Thank you. Good morning and welcome in to The Daily Perspective. Mark Congleton, your sometimes humble host here. Piloting the crazy train down the tracks of life as we explore this hour of observation, insight, and absurdity. It's good to have you along on this Halloween. Happy Halloween. It's the 31st of October, 2019. Good to have you along. Thank you so much for being there. Thanks for sharing the show with your friends and just making it a part of your day. Means a lot to me. Thank you very much. Hopefully you've got big plans for the day. If you've got little ones, I know you do. You'll be busy doing something with those youngins. And, God, a lot of people already have. I don't know if you've, in your driving around, if you have noticed, and in your social media, you have noticed the notices about events like neighborhood get-togethers, Halloween get-togethers, churches doing trunk or treat, things like that. Lots of things going on around the holiday of Halloween. It's not really a holiday, actually. It's just a day that everybody decides, let's just be goofy and dress up and as weird stuff and go out and get lots of sugary stuff from neighbors and people we've never met. Let's go knock on strangers' doors and just accept what they give to us. I just think that's a little problematic. But then again, who am I to say? You know, who am I to say? It's just, you know.
How dare you?
Well, I have an opinion. Come on. You know your neighbors, that's fine. But come on, you guys who haul your kids off to neighborhoods where you don't live, you load them up in the car, the truck, the SUV, the motorhome, and you haul them down streets that you don't know. You people, I want to know something about you people. What's wrong with you? Anyway, happy Halloween. Have a big one. Hope you have a great time with the kiddos this year. And just a quick reminder, I have been lax in this. I've just, you know, it's been slipping my mind all week long. But this weekend, we end daylight saving time. And there's no S on the end of saving. It's just daylight saving time. It ends early Sunday morning, so set those clocks back before you go to bed Saturday night, or you'll be walking into church, and you'll be thinking, "Where is everybody?" Anyway, it's set the clocks back this coming Sunday morning early or Saturday night late when you go to bed, and don't be embarrassed wherever you have to be the next day. Okay, all right. So there you have that. Now, what else do we have in the news here? Oh, yeah. The World Series finally ended. The Washington Nationals have won the 2019 World Series. They defeated the Houston Astros in, 6-2 in Game 7. The first World Series title ever for the Nationals, which relocated from Montreal in 2005. The first for the city since the Washington Senators won the World Series way back in 1924. Howie Kendrick and Anthony Rendon homered in the seventh inning as the Washington Nationals overcame a two-run deficit to take the decisive game. Nats pitcher Steven Strasburg was awarded the World Series MVP. Strasburg won two of the four Nationals victories in the series. He also became the first pitcher ever to go 5-0 in the playoffs in a single year. So congrats to the Washington Nationals, whose logo looks an awful lot like Walgreens. They won the World Series. I've already seen things online this morning with pictures of Walgreens. Walgreens drugstores with big congratulations on them. I thought I was the only person that saw that. I've been saying it for days. You know, I didn't know Walgreens had a team in the World Series. Good for you guys. Oh, maybe it's just funny to just me. I don't know. Maybe it's the weather. Getting cold here. I rolled over this morning when the alarm went off. Everybody uses their smartphone as their alarm clock now, right? Pretty much everybody. I mean, if you're under a certain age, which is like 103, you are using your smartphone for practically everything. And one of the functions is the alarm clock. And on iPhones, in iOS, you've got a feature called bedtime, which is just great. You can tell it how long you want to sleep, when you want to go to bed, and it 15 minutes before you really need to be in the sack, it nudges you a little bit. It lets you know, hey, bedtime's in 15 minutes. And then it keeps track of things for you. And it wakes you up in the morning at the time you said you wanted to wake up. So this morning, the alarm goes off, and I roll over and hit the little button on the screen to stop it and yawn and stretch and notice that the little screen, you know, and you guys know, if you have an iPhone, you know that first screen you see in the morning, it says good morning, and it tells you a little bit about the day. One of the items it tells you about the day is the weather forecast, and it says the high for today will be, what was it? Hang on, let me look. I just have to be absolutely certain that I'm right here. The high for today was something like 68, right? It was the high for today. Let me pull this up here. Here it is. good. It says, good morning. Sunny today. It's currently 71. The high will be 68. Wait a minute. If it's 71, how can the high be 3 degrees lower than what it is right now? Hello? My phone is confused, and it's confusing me. But the high today is going to be 68. Temps falling all day long where I live. So we've got a cold front coming through, and the temperatures are dropping. It's going to be down in the 30s for some places around here. It's just going to be much, much colder than it has been in recent days. So we have gone, in the span of about a month, from temperatures in the 90s, the upper 90s, the temperatures in the 40s. Think about that. In the span of just a small number of weeks, around a month, we've gone from high temps in the 90s down to the into the mid-40s. It's just, wow. Wow. No wonder the dog doesn't like going outside. Let's see, what else have we got here before we get really moving into stuff? Kamala Harris, or Kamala Harris, or you pick a pronunciation, Harris. Her presidential campaign laying off dozens of staffers now. They're giving top officials pay cuts. They're struggling to compete effectively with the front runners. Why would they compete with the front runners? They're so far back, they can't compete with the front runners. This is according to a campaign memo from yesterday. The memo, first reported by Politico, reveals major changes, mass layoffs, pay cuts, redeployment of field staffers in key primary states around the country. They're sending them to Iowa. That's where the campaign is. It's just laying all its cards on the table in Iowa. That's what they're doing. In a field of 18 candidates, we face an incredibly competitive resource environment, says the memo from campaign manager Juan Rodriguez. It goes on to say, to effectively compete with the top campaigns and make the necessary investments in the critical final 100 days to the caucus, we need to reduce expenditures elsewhere and realign resources. Can I translate that for you? We've blown 3 million more than we got in, so we're having to make some cuts here. We basically suck, and everybody knows we suck, and nobody wants to vote for us, so we're cutting back. There's your translation. Rodriguez said he, along with all campaign consultants, will take pay cuts, and the campaign will trim and renegotiate contracts. Somebody's not getting paid. Additionally, staff currently deployed in New Hampshire, Nevada, and Harris's home state of California will be redeployed to Iowa. The campaign's most recent filing revealed it spent about $3 million more than it raised last quarter. That's what I was saying. Meanwhile, Harris has continued to fall in the polls since her brief surge earlier this year. The memo says no candidate spent more time in Iowa this past month than Harris did. Polls in the state, however, show and the increased attention hasn't translated into increased support. Gee, I wonder why. Come on, Kamala Harris is a very unlikable individual. The current Real Clear Politics polling average from Iowa has her behind primary frontrunners Elizabeth Warren, Joe Biden, and Bernie Sanders, and deadlocked with Pete Buttigieg, Amy Klobuchar. Did you forget she was in the mix as well? I know it's easy because she's just like, who? Who is that? Tom Steyer and Andrew Yang. Also, she's deadlocked with it. She's, in other words, she's tied for last place with five other people. In one October Iowa poll from Emerson, Harris found herself in 10th place behind even more Montana Governor Steve Bullock. Did you know he was in the race? I know it's easy to forget. The clown car is full of people. And Steve Bullock failed to qualify for either of the last two primary debates. She's been behind him, and she managed to get into the debates. How's that happening? The Harris campaign has not yet announced who has been laid off. Campaign press secretary Ian Sams did not respond to a request for additional details on the reorganization. So, bless her heart, Kamala Harris looks like she is, her campaign is on life support, and she is campaigning until the money runs out. I think that's how it works. I think that's actually what's happening here. And I've said before, I have to wonder how it is that some of these people wind up campaigning and how some of these people keep campaigning when they're so far down in the list of preferable candidates that people sometimes forget they're there. Now, not her. She has managed to make enough waves that you know who she is, and you've been kind of paying attention. But she's got so little support. Everything is going. It's assuming room temperature. It's going tango uniform. It's just going south for the winter. Shall we speak? It is just going badly for her. And when you see her speak, she doesn't instill a lot of confidence in you, does she? I mean, you shake your head and think, wow, she really thinks these people are stupid. These people she's talking to, she really thinks these people are idiots if they're going to believe what she's saying. Because she has some bizarre positions on things. She is a dangerous individual. She's an unlikable individual. She has basically sleazed her way into her position. Just go look up her relationships, the things she's done to get where she is, and you'll understand what I'm talking about. Just do a little research. You should anyway. But the thing is, I'm amazed she's still in the race anyway. I mean, she tanked pretty hard after Tulsi Gabbard came out after her. Remember that? You know, Tulsi came out and talked about her real record in California. How she really performed or didn't in California. What she really did or didn't do in California. And Tulsi Gabbard just unloaded everything on her. Loaded all barrels and pulled the trigger. Boom. And Kamala Harris suffered a lot after that happened. So I think probably as a result of that, she got broadsided. She's got a big hole in the side amidships and been taking on water ever since. And she's been throwing money at it to the tune of $3 million more than she's taken in. And now she's having to cut back. It's just a matter of time before the flags on the SS Kamala are being flown at half-mast and everybody will be saluting as it sinks into the horizon because she's going to be gone. It's just a matter of time. Now, I got to go back to this question. How is it that these people, these candidates, they raise millions upon millions of dollars and throw that money at campaigning when there is little or no chance whatsoever that they're going to become the president of the United States? What benefit does it bring to them for being a failure, especially a bottom of the pack failure? I just have to wonder, what kind of financial benefit is there for doing this? This is something that could be interesting to look into, to look at past failed presidential candidates, look at their campaigns, look at their spending, and then look at how they're doing afterwards, financially speaking. Because I have a feeling that if you did a little digging, you would find out they're not doing too badly at all. I have a feeling that these people go into this thinking, I'm either going to win or I'm going to get rich. I think that's what it boils down to. And by the way, if they win, they get rich too. Because you look at past presidents, the Obamas would do. Look at the Obamas and look at their financial situation before the presidency and look at it now. bless their hearts, they've just thrown everything they've had into everything, and they came out the other side so much poorer they could buy a $15 million mansion. Yeah. Definitely something financially fishy going on there. So, when you see the clown car and all of the people in it, all of these candidates vying for your attention, it's probably a good thing to remember that if they don't win, they're probably going to be even better off than they were when they started running for the race. More after the break, when the Daily Perspective continues. This is the Daily Perspective. Hi there, Mark Congleton, your sometimes humble host here. Wading through the weirdness that is life in America today. Good to have you along. I do appreciate you being there.
How dare you?
No, seriously, I mean it. Really, I do. It is the Thursday edition of the podcast. It is October 31st, Halloween. Boo. And it's getting cold where I live. I know. If you live where it's been cold and you're already getting snow, yeah, I know. Here in the South, we don't. No, it just doesn't happen here. Like I said yesterday, we get one flake and the Piggly Wiggly goes insane and everybody buys everything. Milk and bread. That's what they buy. What are they making? Milk sandwiches? I just want to know. Why is it milk and bread? I can't figure out what you can make with milk and bread, except maybe French toast, and you gotta have eggs for that. So why not milk, bread, and eggs? I won't go there. Anyway, it is the Halloween edition of the program, and nothing is scarier than life in the real world when it comes to politics. So we'll just stick to that today. Apparently, we know who the whistleblower is now. It started bubbling forward yesterday, or bubbling to the surface yesterday, late yesterday afternoon. I started seeing little references to it, and I wanted to wait for a while to make sure things were coming into focus. Saw Sean Hannity really go nuts on it last night. I watched a couple of minutes of him talking about it, how they had, you know, they were very careful to vet everything. And I'm saying, yeah, you looked at the same sources I did. It's called Facebook. He actually does his due diligence, so I'm proud of him for doing that. That's a very good thing. So he announced, and it's all over the web today, that they know who the whistleblower is now. And coming from the Federalist Papers, Carmine, respect my authority, Carmine Sabia says Democrats are in a panic as the secret identity of their fabled whistleblower has been revealed, and it shows they are not unbiased. The identity of the whistleblower has been referred to as an open secret in Washington, D.C., but now that name could be known to everyone, according to Real Clear Investigations. I actually went and looked at the Real Clear Investigations report, and I chose this source because it's shorter and a little more concise. But you should go look at Real Clear Investigations and look at what they have to say about this. Here's part of that. But the name of a government official fitting that description, Eric Charamella, has been raised privately in impeachment depositions, according to officials with direct knowledge of the proceedings, as well as in at least one open hearing held by a House committee not involved in the impeachment inquiry. Fearing their anonymous witness could be exposed, Democrats this week blocked Republicans from asking more questions about him and intend to redact his name from all deposition transcripts. Well, that's interesting. Why would they do that? Let's keep going. Real Clear Investigations is disclosing the name because of the public's interest in learning details of an effort to remove a sitting president from office. Further, the official's status as a whistleblower is complicated by his being a hearsay reporter of accusations against the president, one who has some indicia of an arguable political bias in favor of a rival political candidate. As the community inspector general phrased it circumspectly in originally fielding his complaint. Federal documents reveal that 33-year-old Charamella, a registered Democrat held over from the Obama White House, previously worked with former Vice President Joe Biden and former CIA Director John Brennan. He's a vocal critic of Trump who helped initiate the Russia collusion investigation of the Trump campaign during the 2016 election. Further, Charamella left his national security posting in the White House's West Wing in mid-2017 amid concerns about negative leaks to the media. He has since returned to CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia. A former National Security Council official said he was accused of working against Trump and leaking against Trump. Also, Charamella huddled for guidance with the staff of House Intelligence Committee Chairman Adam Schiff, including former colleagues also held over from the Obama era, whom Schiff's office had recently recruited from the NSC. And Charamella worked with a Democratic National Committee operative who dug up dirt on the Trump campaign during the 2016 election, inviting her into the White House for meetings, former White House colleagues said. Documents confirm the DNC opposition researcher attended at least one White House meeting with Charamella in November of 2015. She visited the White House with a number of Ukrainian officials lobbying the Obama administration for aid for Ukraine, they say. And, of course, Twitter is popping with responses. Benny Johnson posted, "The White House whistleblowers, Eric Charamella, registered Democrat, worked for Obama, worked with Joe Biden, worked with for CIA Director John Brennan, vocal critic of Trump, helped initiate the Russia collusion investigation hoax." And it goes on and on and on. So, the name of the whistleblower apparently is Eric Charamella. And as I just said, he is a registered Democrat. He worked for Barack Obama. He worked with Vice President Joe Biden. He worked for CIA Director John Brennan, a rabid anti-Trumper, by the way, a vocal critic himself of Trump, and he helped initiate the Russia collusion investigation hoax. So now we know who this guy is. Where does this put us? And what does it mean? I guess we'll have to see how things play out. But it's interesting that Adam Schiff and his cohorts, his partners in crime in the Democrat Party, have kept the identity of this person very, very tightly under wraps. They knew that if we knew who this person was, that we would put the pieces together and realize this guy's been working against Trump since before he became president. He is not impartial. He's just another stooge in the lineup. He's just one more anti-Trumper who's working against the president of the United States, coming from the hard left. And his testimony would be tossed. And most of us tossed it anyway, didn't we? Because when we got the transcript of the conversation that's in question, we understood the accusations made by the whistleblower were baseless. Now, the Democrats are currently trying to get others involved who could have been in on the conversation, because these things don't happen in a vacuum. There are people involved. There are people who listen while conversations like this are going on. For example, those who transcribe. There are people who type faster than you can think. This is their profession. It's what they do. They're listening and they're typing up everything as it's said. And they're trying to get somebody from inside that little group of people who were privy to this conversation to come in and, quote, correct the transcript, end quote. Their position is that the transcript released by the White House is a lie. And this is what your liberal friends are clinging to, that Donald Trump is a liar and that the transcript is a lie. So they are hoping to find someone to come and correct the transcript, because they're hanging everything on this whistleblower testimony. But now we know the whistleblower's background. We know who he is, and we know what he is. We know he's a registered Democrat. We know he worked for Obama. And we've been seeing that this entire process began under Obama. And we have been seeing that Obama knew everything that was going on. He also worked with Joe Biden, the Democrats' top candidate, in the effort to defeat President Trump in the election next year. He worked for CIA Director John Brennan, rabid anti-Trumper. He's been a vocal critic of Trump, and he helped initiate the Russia collusion investigation hoax, which began under Barack Obama. So we know who this guy is, and we know what this guy is. So pretty much anything he has to say, henceforth, is meaningless because it's partisan, it's tainted, and we know why he said what he said. So if they succeed in finding someone to correct the transcript, we need to look at them just as closely. Because whoever would correct that transcript probably has the same sort of background as this guy does. The whistleblower, Eric Ciaramella. Something to hold on to today. And knowledge that you should use as part of your filter when you are listening to or watching the news. We know who these people are. We know what they are. They are leftists. Many of them radical leftists who want to fundamentally transform our country. Welcome back to The Daily Perspective. Good to have you along. It is the Halloween edition of the podcast, October 31st, 2019. And there is plenty going on to talk about. But I'm going to let somebody else do some talking here for just a couple of minutes. Tucker Carlson had Brit Hume on the other night, and they were talking about President Trump and all of the stuff that's happening in and around his presidency. And Brit Hume had some very interesting observations about the president, about his personality, and about what's happening as far as this impeachment push is, you know, how that's going. And I thought it was interesting, and I thought I'd just pass it along to you. It is between 4.5 and 5 minutes long. So let's dive in and see what Brit Hume has to say.
Brit Hume is the senior political analyst here at Fox, not just for chronological reasons, but for reasons of wisdom, and we're always grateful to have him on. What's the point? So as a political matter, do you think, Brit, is the point of impeachment? We're all laboring under the assumption that there will be no removal. So why do it?
Well, if a president impeached, is a president to some extent tarnished?
Yes.
And embarrassed?
Yes.
So if they can't get him removed, they can at least touch him up a bit in the hope that that will contribute to his not being reelected.
I think
that's clearly what's in play here. And, you know, the president clearly doesn't want this. He said as much publicly. He didn't
that's
want
right.
to impeach. No president would want to be impeached. So this is something they have the power to do. The question is whether they can do so and at the same time protect Democrats in the House, whose districts were carried by Mr. Trump, from being damaged politically by the impeachment, which will not go down well in those districts, one presumes, and whether then they have any hope of getting his impeachment affirmed, that is to say, by a conviction in the Senate. Everybody says it's clear that the Senate will not do this. I think it's very unlikely the Senate would do this. After all, the president only there are 53 Republicans in the Senate. The president can lose 19 of them,
yes.
19, and still survive in office. So a lot of this is about trying to A, protect those Democrats and still proceed with this impeachment inquiry. And about trying to win over some Republicans in the Senate. And, you know, a majority of them can go against him and he still survives. So, I think the president is really in pretty good shape here. But think about this, Tucker. If you're a Republican in the Senate and the impeachment article conforms to this conversation that's supposedly all about.
Yes.
It is. First of all, you have to kind of interpret it to conclude that he was demanding a quid pro quo, that is to say, he was going to withhold the aid unless and until the investigation was conducted. In the end, the aid was not withheld, and the investigation he supposedly was insisting upon was not undertaken. So it does leave you wondering whether, if you're a Republican senator, you're going to vote for a conviction of a man on that basis.
So what you're saying is, as a factual matter, as distinct from a matter of intent, nothing happened.
Right. I mean, this is another case. It reminds you a little bit of the Trump Tower meeting, the fabled Trump Tower meeting,
yeah,
in which Don Jr. expressed a desire and a willingness to receive dirt information from these Russian representatives who came to see him
right.
in Trump Tower. Nothing came of it. And it was considered to be kind of Exhibit A in the collusion case.
So he had impure thoughts, basically.
Well, he did, and he said when the possibility that he would receive such dirt was transmitted to him, he said, "I love it." Right. So that looks bad.
I've sent a lot of texts like that. Yes.
So the Mueller team investigates this for 2 years with all the investigative powers at the disposal of the federal government, and decided it didn't go anywhere, and that was the end of it. And so this, in effect, ended up not going anywhere. You know, and it's so like this president to kind of lay about himself and demanding this and demanding that and saying people are treasonous and saying they ought to be fired and they ought to go to jail and, you know, and the rest of it. And it's a lot of it is just bluster. It's just bluster on his part. And, you know, he's inexperienced in foreign affairs, so he's on the phone with some leader, and he has this rambling, kind of disconnected conversation in which he says, "You need to do me a favor," and then he mentions some things, and then later on he says, "You know, we need to investigate and see about the Bidens." Well, maybe he meant that as a quid pro quo, maybe he didn't.
But what's so interesting is that at least a couple of the people, some of the most powerful testimony has come so far in the House from people who were legitimately shocked that the president might have a different policy position.
Oh, yeah. Well, one of the things you keep hearing is that one of the things the president was disturbing here was established American foreign policy. And that these diplomats and other officials, they represent that. Hmm. As if the foreign policy is not supposed to be set by the president, which constitutes...
As if it's not a democracy.
Right. Well, it certainly, and democracy or no democracy, we have this constitution that reposes the power to set foreign policy in the president. So it is supposedly their job to carry out the policies that he sets, for better or for worse. Now, this may, you know, I'm not going to get into whether this is a good policy or
right,
not.
Right. No, that's a separate question.
That's a separate question. But the fact that these guys didn't like it is not a matter that should be in
right,
play here.
They act like it's his job to carry out their views.
Well, let's establish America.
Ah, the pomposity, yeah. My gosh. Britt Hume, thank you,
you
as always.
Very interesting observations from analyst Britt Hume. He's an interesting guy. He tends to be honest and straightforward. You may not agree with him, but he's not, as far as I can tell, he's not trying to convince you of anything. He's just telling you the way he sees it. And his observations about the president, I think, are spot on, that he does bluster. He does throw things out just for the sake of throwing things out there. And the attitude of the insiders, the, like, shall we say, deep staters in Washington, D.C., who want everyone to think that he is disrespecting people whose job it is to do what he tells them to do. It's not the other way around. That this is something that has been common throughout his presidency, is the accusation that he is an idiot and doesn't know how these things work. Well, if you look back over his comments over decades about politics, you will see he's been pretty much consistent for the whole time. And he is an observer. He does know what's going on. And he has said himself on, when was it? It was right before the election. Wasn't it in October, right before the election? I'm actually looking for that soundbite right now to see if I can pull it up for you. But he talked about how corrupt Washington, D.C. was. He talked about how, basically, as Obi-Wan Kenobi said, it was a den of iniquity. You know, it's just a terrible place, and terrible things are going on there. And it's just that when we hear what he has to say, we know where he stands, and then we have these people, these leftists in D.C. trying to translate everything and to have it mean something completely different than it does. We're told every day that he's lying. Was it CNN said something about there were like 90 lies just in one day last week? I would say, just if I'm going to be honest here, that if they track the previous administration as closely as they do the current administration, and if CNN was honest, that's the tough part right there, because we know they're not. You would probably find out that they were lying as much or more. And what do they call a lie? I think many times Trump, when faced by reporters, just throws crap at them. And they fact check him. And he knows they're going to fact check him. And he throws stuff at them anyway, just because he knows they're going to go crazy and accuse him of things. And it doesn't matter to him. In the big picture, doesn't matter. Yeah, we found aliens on the moon. I got to go. Helicopter's waiting. He says outrageous things to the press, knowing the press is going to fact check him and point fingers and grasp their pearls, clutch their pearls, gasp and scream, "Liar!" And the rest of us are all looking at the press going, "Wow, you guys need to, you know, it may be time to change your meds." Because they're going nuts. Oh, my Lord. It's just a crazy, crazy situation. And on one hand, it's entertaining. On another hand, it's extremely revealing. And I know I've said this before, but I really believe that one of the objectives that Donald Trump has is to expose the Democrats and the mainstream news media for what they really are. And part of that process is saying things and doing things which will cause them to react. When people react, we see who they really are. That knee-jerk reaction. When they react to something which they find shocking or inappropriate, we get a little glimpse into how they really tick. And this is something that someone who is seasoned in the business world understands perfectly. If he thinks, as a businessman, that a department head or possibly someone running one of his businesses is being less than honest, he can say things which will cause reactions that will let him know, yep, they've been lying to me. Or they're hiding things. Or will clue him off that he needs to look deeper into a situation to find out what's really going on. And he's applying these kinds of business sensibilities that he has gleaned over years of being an extraordinarily successful businessman. Yes, I know he's filed bankruptcy, what, 5 times? Out of over 200 businesses? That's not bad. Trust me, it's not bad. You don't win all the time. But over all these years, he's gleaned a little information, a little knowledge, a little wisdom, and he's applying it in a way that these critters from the swamp can't understand, because all they've ever done is politics. They don't live in the real world. Welcome back to the Daily Perspective. Oh my, this bumper music comes up and it made me remember that there's a version by a bunch of bluegrass players, which is really, really fun. It's a Halloween edition of the program, and I figure the scariest thing we've got going on in America is politics, so that's what we focused on today. Real quickly, before I get into the next thing, there's a claim being made about Jeffrey Epstein. We're all familiar with the Jeffrey Epstein story and the fact that he was in jail, being held in jail. Conditions there changed from the way they were supposed to be. He was supposed to have a cellmate so that he would never be alone. There were supposed to be 2 guards on duty that night, cameras, the whole 9 yards. And oddly enough, every last bit, all of the redundancy that they put in place to make sure that nothing fishy would happen to him, all of it fell apart. It all fell apart. And so he was alone, the cameras didn't work, the guards fell asleep, and suddenly he's dead. Yes, that does smell very fishy, doesn't it? Well, his brother, Jeffrey Epstein's brother, hired a Dr. Michael Baden, 85 years of age, for his to observe the autopsy of Jeffrey Epstein. They have officially said that he killed himself on August 10th while he was awaiting trial on sex trafficking charges involving female minors. Dr. Baden gave his expert opinion yesterday on Fox and Friends. He's a former New York City medical examiner with decades of experience in high-profile forensic pathology cases. And he said he was talking about these fractures in Epstein's neck. He said these three fractures, those three fractures are extremely unusual in suicidal hangings and could occur much more commonly in homicidal strangulation. I've not seen in 50 years where that occurred in a suicidal hanging case. A number of other experts have made similar observations in the past, but after an unexpected delay, New York City medical examiner Barbara Sampson on August 16th ruled Epstein's death had been caused by suicide by hanging. And they have responded to the statement by Dr. Baden saying, or is it Baden? I don't know. Anyway, they've responded to the doctor's statement saying that they stand by their judgment. They stand by what they have said. And my first thought was, of course they stand by what they've said. This is New York. There may not be a more corrupt city in the nation. Of course they stood by what they said. I think anybody with a brain who is honest is questioning what happened to Jeffrey Epstein. And when you look at the circumstances, and I know it's all circumstantial, but when you look at these circumstances surrounding his death, you can't help but raise an eyebrow and think, that's suspicious. At the very least. And so now we have a guy with an abundance of experience who has come forth and said he observed the autopsy, he saw what's happened, and he in his career has never, even though it can happen, he's never seen it happen, that this kind of an injury is caused by a suicide hanging. Murder? Yes. Hanging? No. Also, Epstein was found with the sheet that he'd wrapped, you know, that they found around his neck, on his knees. This kind of injury can occur in a hanging if the drop is far enough, because the weight of the body against the rope, gravity and all, can cause it to happen. Epstein was on his knees on the floor. There are those who are saying that's not enough to cause that kind of injury. So that's what's happening right now. And of course, as I said, New York is denying it. More to come. Now, I don't know about you, but Nikki Haley, I think, is an admirable person as far as politics goes. She had some things to say about the people criticizing people in the Trump administration who are undermining him. She was speaking at the annual dinner of the American Enterprise Institute, and she criticized colleagues of hers in the Trump administration who believe that the best thing to do for America was to undermine and obstruct the president. She asserts the president was the choice of the people in accordance with our founding charter. No policy disagreement with him, no matter how heartfelt, justifies undermining the lawful authority that is vested in his office by the Constitution. Haley's speech was redolent with praise for America's role in the world and optimism for the future. As she stated, I want to start by saying I'm optimistic about America's future. I know that for those who spend too much time on Twitter, it may at times look like it's all over for the American experiment. Depending on which cable network you prefer, there is a sense that things are coming off the rails in America today. But America has survived a revolution, a foreign invasion, a civil war, a Great Depression, the largest war in world history, and social unrest of a dozen different stripes. And we've come out stronger after every test. we have lots of people who are attempting to reject the very things that set America apart. This is a real problem, and it's one we should strongly resist. Our history is being attacked as a lie. Influential voices on the left claim America was founded not in freedom, but in oppression. The idea that we must be in control of our borders is dismissed as uncaring bigotry. Some are attempting to redefine American citizenship itself. Haley countered those perspectives, recalling her experience at the UN and comparing the American experience to those from other countries. She said, "What I saw cut through the loud and polarizing voices in our country. I saw what sets America apart, what we must protect and preserve. When you've heard a South Sudanese refugee woman tell you about watching soldiers throw her baby into a fire, when you've seen Venezuelan families walk for hours in the blazing sun to reach Colombia in order to receive the one meal they'll have that day, when you've negotiated with representatives of a Chinese regime that is building a surveillance state that would horrify Orwell, when you've seen and done these things, you see just how profound the gifts are that we have received as Americans." She quoted President Calvin Coolidge's statement on the 150th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. "Amid all the clash of conflicting interests, amid all the welter of partisan politics, every American can turn for solace and consolation to the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution of the United States." She continued, saying, "That statement is just as fitting today. Equality before law, freedom, inalienable rights, these are not abstractions. They are our inheritance as human beings. The Declaration of Independence outlined them. The Constitution established them as a system of government. It is these sacred principles that make me optimistic." Haley decried those who would call upon America to relinquish its role as an advocate of freedom and human dignity abroad, saying bluntly, "A world without the United States leadership does not mean a world in which our values and interests peacefully coexist with other countries. If it meant countries could live peacefully pursuing their interests, there would be more to recommend the United States retreating from the world. Instead, it means a world with Chinese values devoted to Chinese interests. It means a world with Russian values devoted to Russian interests. It means a world in which radical Islam runs rampant. That is a dark place for American values and a dangerous place for American security. If you don't believe me, I invite you to spend a day in the United Nations Security Council. Some of its most powerful members not only don't share American values, they actively work to defeat them. We faced a choice. Either sacrifice our values in an attempt to win friends at the UN or defend our values and fight some fights virtually alone. Freedom and human dignity aren't just the right values to promote. They are our most powerful foreign policy tools, which is why we fought for them." There's more to this. You should check show notes today. I'll post them after the show. Read the rest of what she had to say. It's powerful stuff. As I've said many times, without the United States of America, the world is a much worse place. Because of us, millions of people live today who would not live if we were not here. God bless America. Let's protect it, friends. Have a great day. We'll see you tomorrow. God bless. Bye-bye.
Oh, we're done.